I want to start by saying I'm sorry that the Gita Lamai breast interpretations for tonight have been cancelled. Otherwise, they would have been very worthwhile. The great French film, war films about the First World War by Renoir, which, if you haven't seen, you could see just as a matter of principle. Now, I think I should stop for a minute and say something about last night's film. I think it should be pretty clear how it integrates into the course. You have read so many attacks on the school from Wedekind. You've read Nietzsche, what Nietzsche says about school and teachers. And all of this is, in a way, exemplified by Professor Garbage, by Professor Unrath, which is his original name, of the novel by Heinrich Mann, is exemplified by him, of course. And remember something else, that in plays, the novel was published at about the same time as Turner. Therefore, it doesn't play among students. It is the same attitude towards institutions and towards domination. But of course, here it is turned around, and as you gather, the story is of a tyrant who disintegrates. The tyrant, the teacher, the tyrant who disintegrates because he gives in to his emotions, because, as Gide would say, he follows his nature. So remember that what Professor Garbage does, and what gets him into trouble, and what gets him to end up as a clown, and remember the contrast between tyrant and clown in the movie, by the way he starts and the way he ends, the difference is, of course, Marlene Dietrich. Now, following your nature, not with gamekeepers, but with Marlene Dietrich, but it comes to the same thing, in a sense. You see what I mean? So, that this is really the sense of it. Now, as to the figure of Marlene Dietrich, of course, you can make up your own realization about it. It is, of course, a figure of the temptress, but it is, of course, much more than that. It is, in a sense, the figure of the outsider, of, if you like, somebody who does follow her nature. Somebody who is, after all, though she follows her nature, basically kind and good, though you can disagree with it. That depends what view you take of the institution of the school and all of that sort of thing. Now, clearly, Professor Unrath is not influenced by Nietzsche, and here I come to a question some of you asked last time. To be sure, and I'll come back to it, the influence of Nietzsche on the literary imagination is very great. Because in the literary imagination, you are not bound to rule a country. You can even do things which has no relation to your personal life. In other words, you can have your literary or artistic imagination without responsibility, or rather, discarding any responsibility. And you can certainly be a Nietzschean in your imagination, even if it is quite something different in being a Nietzschean in life. Now, what is influenced, therefore, by Nietzsche? And you must get your chronology right. I have a feeling many of you don't know it very well, and that is why I put the dates on the board together with the books. Please remember that. So, that obviously Nietzsche's influence comes really only after 1900. And that, as you will see, in a very dubious way, because his sister edited his works. The true Nietzsche we only have in the 1950s. Until the 1950s, most of the true Nietzsche was not available. Now, to come to that, because his nationalistic sister edited his works. That you must keep in mind, too. So before 1900, you can have no influence of Nietzsche, obviously. But after 1900, you have the influence of Nietzsche on the literary imagination. And you have it there, of course, and I want to say that now, very strong. a whole generation of young writers, which are people you know. G, because it is again connected to this question of the artist's relation to life. So you have G in The Immoralist, if you read, put forward Mikael, who wants to be an Nietzschean, but who is pulled down by women, a very Nietzschean sort of thing, no? Marceline, the weak woman, who whenever he follows his nature with the gamekeeper, gets sick. And here again, you have this idea of doctors. The doctor is the prophet. It's again a matter of sickness and health. Here you have no longer Christian ideas, but medical ideas, which I have told you all along. The custodian of sexual morality is now in the hands of the physician. And Jean is very clear about this, because the analogy is not sin and redemption. The analogy is illness and health. The bourgeois conscience of Mikael, which is the woman, typically, now falls sick. And you can say that he should have been Zarathustra and taken the whip to Marceline. And then he might really have enjoyed himself. But of course, the whole matter is that tension between holiness and Zarathustra, between holiness and following your nature. Now the same idea you have in a whole series of artists. You have it in D.H. Lawrence in England. You have it in a book like Lady Chatterley's Lover, very strongly. It's not very unlike these Immoralist in this. But you also have the idea in this case to live life to the fullest, which in Lady Chatterley's Lover, of course, means enjoyment. And again means, and that's part of it now, the quest for virility. Lady Chatterley is always questing for virility. And her husband is indeed somebody who is a pale face, a mistrust. In the end. Indeed, there is a very typical exhortation in Lady Chatterley's Lover, where Lawrence says, or Lady Chatterley says, that the men of her generation are scared of life. Now, that is the kind of Nietzschean influence on the literary imagination. To be scared of life, but to be scared of life because you are not virile. It is assumed, in a way, not by Lawrence, Lady Chatterley is a very virile figure, really, but by Jean, certainly, that women are the bourgeois conscience, the passive, the bourgeois conscience, that you must not be scared of life, and that therefore you have, especially in D.H. Lawrence, all these leadership or Nietzschean figures. It's not only the gamekeepers, again, as I told you, in Lady Chatterley's Lover, there's something about a gamekeeper. Oh, somebody asked me, what's a gamekeeper? Yes, well, I hope you don't have that experience, do you? Because there are no gamekeepers around. But the question, what is a gamekeeper? A gamekeeper is not quite what you call in America a game warden. A gamekeeper does two things. He guards the game, I mean the game that is to be hunted, from poachers. But he also drives the game together so that the Lord can shoot it. In other words, he has these two functions, yes? These two active functions. He keeps out the poachers and he drives the game together, just in case you didn't know what a gamekeeper was. I wish you'd ask these questions rather than think it to your imagination. So, in other words, for literary people, there is no need to come down from the mountain. Clear. There's no need to come down from the mountain at all, or for artists. And so, that you have in D.H. Lawrence constantly these leader figures, the famous such in his Australian novel, Kangaroo, a very good novel, I think he got Australia dead right. But D.H. Lawrence's Kangaroo, where you have a leadership figure. And you have, therefore, in that young generation, this kind of longing for leadership, for virility. And you have it too in the expressionists. That's one thing that perhaps I haven't stressed enough, because the expressionists were obviously influenced by Nietzsche
and the shriek of the expressionist, this urge towards action, this urge towards murder the father. That's a very virile thing to do. You murder the father. The fact that in expressionist literature there are no positive women, really. The women are the mothers, very negative figures, as it were. All of this shows you again the influence of Nietzscheanism on what you might call the expressionist shriek. That must be clear. But it is equally clear that neither your Wedekind reading nor Heinrich Mann were influenced, of course, by Nietzsche to any degree. There is no Nietzschean character except the man in the mask in Wedekind. You can say that in Wedekind, the man in the mask is a kind of prefiguration of Nietzsche. Because remember, nobody was really influenced of Nietzsche after 1900, and Wedekind is 1892. So it is a kind of prefiguration when the man in the mask says to Moritz, he says, you know, don't be a crybaby. Don't play it with all your parents. It's you. It's your decision. It's in your head. That's, of course, a kind of prefiguration of the Nietzschean impulse, which is anyhow generally in the age, if you want to put it that way, generally in the age, simply because there is this longing for leadership, this longing for great experience, this longing from out of the genitribal society. That out from the genitribal society always has a Nietzschean kind of impulse. The longing for leadership, for virility, the longing out of what Ezra Pound called so nicely the formless wobble of bourgeois society. The only problem is the formless wobble also becomes parliamentary government and discussion and dialogue and this urge for decision, which is, of course, if you like to put it another way, especially applicable, I think, to the literary imagination, the hunger for myth, the hunger for some kind of myth which is outside the bourgeois manners and respectability. The hunger for some kind of great experience. Now, notice in Zarathustra, and notice in Wedekind, in a sense, there is a hunger for experience. We've made a lot of that already. And out of the tribal dinner party, you want experience. After all, Mercure does everything. You know, he has experience with girls, he has experience with boys. He has everything, yes? It is the hunger for experience. And of course, Zarathustra is the same thing. The hunger for experience. The hunger for true experience. That is, an experience of yourself. But still, the hunger for experience. All these accusations in your Zarathustra reading, that the poets aren't real poets, and that virtue isn't real virtue, is really an attempt to get experience. To have the great experience. And that is, of course, one of the reasons, and I want to say it here again, why all of this leads up, in a sense, to youth greeting the First World War. Because the First World War promised to put it all in action. You didn't have to sit and masturbate, mentally or otherwise. You didn't have to hunger for myth. The First World War promised to make you a Nietzschean man. The First World War promised to give you an outlet for your virility. So remember again what I've said before, and I want to say again, that in Nietzsche there is an edge of cruelty, which you don't have perhaps so much in the Blue Angel, or in, but which you certainly have in Turner. So in much that you have read, namely I would say Nietzsche in the Young Turner's movie, yes? To a certain extent, the middle disguise in the Blue Angel, and perhaps even in Wedekind, especially in the beating of Bender, certainly in the beating of Bender, in all of this, there is a kind of tendency towards cruelty, tendency towards inflicting pain, what I would perhaps call tendency towards domination, a tendency towards domination, which goes together with this revolt of bourgeois youth. And because bourgeois society was so mollycoddle, so milquetoast, such a formless wobble, in the tribal society, you didn't hit anything, you only hit children. Come back to children, of course, a little later. You could hit children, but you certainly didn't hit. However, Danny Tribal was angry with Corinna. She didn't belt her one. I would have belted Corinna one myself. You see, Mrs. Tribal, I would have belted a great deal. But, my way. That on the whole, you see, you don't do that. You're nice. But the nicety is a hypocrisy for them. Yes, it is, I suppose, for many of you. No, but you always forget that if we weren't nice, if we didn't have tact, and if we didn't have manners, we'd all eat each other. In other words, remember that all this revolt welcomed the First World War. Remember that all this revolt against manners and morals has that tinge of cruelty. And if you like it so much, you mustn't forget the reverse side of it as well. This longing for the great event, that longing for genuineness, means in the end, welcome, the proof of virility, trying to prove your virility, welcoming the war. I myself, if you ask me, and you haven't, so I give it you free, I think there's been nothing worse than this longing for genuineness, this longing for living out your nature. Because it leads, of course, to what Thomas Hobbes calls the war of one against all, you see. Because basically we are, of course, animals of one sort or another. So we need our leash of manners and morals. This was a very good bourgeois insight, in fact, in my opinion. But however that may be, what is still a fact is the cruelty involved in the search for genuine. And I again connect that with something else I've told you that I want to bring together. That cruelty involved will become, of course, with too much introspection, a real hatred of the other, of the outsider. Remember what I said before when I talked about the painting of Kishiroko, which you can see in the Elvian and all of this. If you look too much into your soul, and this I said in connection with the Expressionists, and especially with the futurists, who became fascists, remember. When you look too much into your soul, eventually anybody outside your soul becomes the other, the outsider, a hostile force upon whom, like Feuerbach, you become a Barzini. You become a Barzini. So, in other words, that is involved too. Not only is there cruelty involved, but there's always the tendency to make the one who is not yourself a Barzini. And their Turles is, of course, extremely prophetic. So you mustn't forget that this goes hand in hand. But as far as the literary imagination is concerned, it was, of course, harmless. As we say in German, paper is paper. You can put anything on paper. Doesn't really matter very much. Paper is paper. But, of course, it didn't remain on paper. Became a release, it became, after all, the volunteers who rushed to the colors and all of that, to which we come eventually. Now I want to pause here for a minute before I go further into the taming of Nietzsche and ask you if by any chance you have any further questions, either on Nietzsche, because on Friday is for 6 weeks. And by the way, up to now there's only one person who is excused from the 6 weeks. Nobody else is. It's not going to be, you have to know something, obviously, but you also have to get some thought. And when you write your 6 weeks, I give you one hint to start, end a little early, so that you read over what you've done and you're sure that you haven't written utter nonsense. So, it's a good hint. Yes.
You said that in Blue Angel there was no.
Not really. Where did you see it?
Where did I see it? Yeah. No, I was just wondering, you said that and then didn't elaborate.
Well, there isn't any chain figure there. Did you see any chain
figure? Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, yes, please. Oh, part of Nietzsche's comment is his view of his own self being idle, because he refers to himself in the pile of the God for you. You know, it's a psychologist and then he tells himself to be idle. And then he says to the master, being idle is sin.
Yes, of course there was in Nietzsche's life a very great contradiction. When he quit his professorship at the University of Basel, and did nothing but writing, and his trend towards activism. He himself in his life was hardly a Nietzschean figure. On the contrary, even before he went insane, he was not a Nietzschean figure. He was what we would call an independent artist, yes? He was more bohemian than a Nietzschean figure, and obviously that induced the conflict.
Yes. Nietzsche, one of the things I had trouble with was the presenting was presenting was not meaning to be interpreted in the ways it was interpreted by time. It seems to me that he's very obsessed with having an effect on people because he does take disciples and he does relate these things. He's very involved.
But you must say he got the wrong disciples. I mean, I'm coming to the taming, but he got the wrong disciples. You see, he's ambivalent about that. You're quite right. Zarathustra wants disciples, yes? He doesn't really want equals. He wants disciples, yes? Whom he can transform, I suppose, eventually into a race of supermen. But as Nietzsche neglects to tell us what will bind this race of supermen together, and the political consequences are not clear. You see what I mean? It is not an elite the way we think of an elite. It's more individual sort of dinosaurs cruising together. You see what I mean? Yeah? So that the interpretation. But as I come to the interpretation, there is no doubt whatsoever that the chief interpretation, nationalism, he really. You can't get around that. That whatever he wants, maybe what he wanted was a kind of elite of the old patriarchs. And you can make out a very good case that the elite he really thought of was not an elite of Germans, but an elite of Jews, for example, whom he somehow identified with the patriarchs, God knows why. So he identified them with the patriarchs. So as he is going to be tamed into nationalism of one sort, yes, but I think he would have understood Jean, and I certainly think he would have understood very well his two disciples, which I say were more D.H. Lawrence and Wyndham Lewis and writers in England of that nature. You see what I mean? Wyndham Lewis, by the way, did become a fan. D.H. Lawrence was kind of sympathizing, but still it's different, yeah? So I think there's no doubt that. And the question that is open, and you can make your own interpretation, the interesting question is, would he have welcomed the First World War? Yeah. Which you could see as not national. You could see it, as I'm sure many of these young people saw it, as simply a new space in which you could, prove your virility. So would Nietzsche have welcomed the First World War as a supernatural event? Yeah. Perhaps there was too much nationalism in it. Emperor William II, I know only German and Germans and all that sort of stuff. Maybe there was too much. I can't tell you. Yeah?
Well, just to make one point, you're always criticizing, it seems to me, that kind of get this feeling that we have this Marxist blaze that we got from the 60s. It's not particularly, Marxist. One thing that if there is a glaze that, that I've picked up is that the effects of your society on the individual, there always is going to be, you're always in that context, you're always going to be influenced. It seems to me that what Nietzsche didn't realize was that he was setting up all these individuals, putting all this power into those individuals. And because he wasn't thinking about how those individuals can relate to society, setting up the potential for disaster.
That's quite clear. I mean, I don't disagree with you. This is not a Marxist insight. The Marxist insight in Nietzsche is that dreadful book by George Lukács, The Destruction of Reason, when he is one of those who makes Nietzsche responsible
because Nietzsche is the anti-Marx in many ways. So a dreadful book by Nietzsche that is struck by Lukács, The Destruction of Reason. But your insight has nothing to do with Marxism. It's an insight that long is before Marxism. It's just a logical insight, which I would extend to everything. My own opinion is that the taming of Nietzsche into nationalism was almost inevitable. Because the only other influence that Nietzsche could have was the influence on the literary imagination. Yes? And on this it went on. I think myself, if you want my opinion, and why shouldn't you have it, that Nietzsche was a pretty dreadful influence. I mean, I am not any change. I have very little to say for Nietzsche, but I don't want to influence you particularly on that subject, because I do believe that the consequences of Nietzsche, while you can see they were good in giving people a thing to follow out their own nature, and therefore contributing to the greater tolerance of our society. But I myself believe that the greater tolerance in our society, let us say, for other manners and morals, let's say for lesbians or gays or women, they are tolerated because they are amusing, and they will in eccentrics, like in Proust, yes? Like in Proust's Guermantes, and that they will soon be no longer tolerated when he ceases to be amusing. At the moment, these are all very harmless things from the point of view of bourgeois society. But when they stop being harmless, when they make alliance with other forces in society, which the women apparently are not going to do very soon, they're not really, they can be tolerated. Why not? You had Proust, and you had Charlus at the Guermantes. They're eccentric. The eccentric is amusing. I mean, we need it. We can talk about a pluralistic society and it makes us beautiful. But as long as it becomes dangerous, I think it's all right. That's one thing. Nietzsche contributed to a certain extension of tolerance, however serious or not. I'm just giving you my opinion, you can differ with it. However obvious is the hypothesis. However serious or not you think. Obviously, I don't think it's going to be too serious. But the second thing of Nietzsche, which I think, I don't want to influence you, yes, is that by ignoring politics and society, he, of course, directly played into the hands of those people who wanted a bourgeois revolution, what I have called an anti-bourgeois revolution, namely a revolution of the spirit rather than a revolution of the social and social system, economically. Yeah. And therefore, Nietzsche was ready-made for nationalism, because nationalism is, if it is anything, a revolution of the spirit. It wants a different political setup, usually, and it wants a different attitude towards life, yes? But economic and social is another matter. So that Nietzsche contributed to this revolution which we are all talking about now, the anti-bourgeois revolution, which I call the plague within a plague. You see what I mean? I think it all contributed to this, yes? And it is my opinion, now this is only my opinion and my analysis, it is my opinion that this revolution that we're dealing with, and that's where we're getting into some length, is the revolution that never ends. That renewed itself, let's say, in the student revolt of the 60s, and anything, it renews itself among bourgeois youths again and again and again. And that is the reason for the great attractiveness of Nietzsche. Nietzsche and psychology have more in common. Nietzsche and Freud, and I'm coming to Freud next week. Nietzsche and Freud, oddly enough, have something in common. Yes? They both make possible personal liberation without social liberation in the end. You couldn't have, That is, of course, why Marxists quite rightly think poorly of psychology and psychoanalysis. And I myself have great doubts about it as well. It makes possible social, personal liberation without, and it becomes in the end, of course, you know, a general fashionable thing. Have you been to your shrink yesterday? Then you can. You adjust better. Well, we'll come to that. But oddly enough, they have this in common. You see what I mean? In my opinion, But then I think all of what we have discussed now have this in common. Maybe in otherwise.
And your analysis of whether my analysis is correct or not must depend on two things, which are up to you to analyze, to make your judgment. First of all, how important are manners and morals? If manners and morals fall down, does that mean a basic change in society or not? I think that's an open question, more open than you think. Yeah. If you think yes, then you are with the expressionist and with Wittgenstein and with Nietzsche and with everybody. And it may well be true that the beginning of the end of the Jenny tribal society is the change in manners and morals. I mean, that's up to your judgment, you know. Is it a symptom or is it something else? Now, don't be misled by these stupid ideas which you all take for granted too much. I read your exam for all these years. You always take for granted what Marx never took for granted, that man is what he eats. You are all apt to have a very primitive sort of economic determinism. That is not Marx at all. That's American positivism. You think that if society changes, everything changes. You think that if economics changes, everything changes. That's nonsense. Economics has changed in communist Europe. But in the Soviet Union, but what has a more petty bourgeois morality than Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union? I don't know. Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union is Jenny tribal in all its purity, and nothing of deviance whatsoever is accepted. So you mustn't be so crude as to think that economic change necessarily means personal liberation. It does not. And it certainly doesn't mean a change of manners and morals that we now know. After 30 years. So that you mustn't be so crude. You mustn't be so crude to believe that economics necessarily changes or leads to personal liberation or even social change. That is crude analysis, uninteresting analysis, positivist analysis, which has very little validity, because you must never forget, as I told you at the beginning, and I'm glad to repeat before the 60s, that history is a dialect between human beings with all their free will and the circumscribing of that free will by conditions. But conditions are multi-layered. Marx, by the way, saw. It's multi-layered. Conditions are manners and morals, your parents, your elders, the economy, social conditions. Most people don't make a great division between them. They come to people. They impinge on people's perception as a package. And therefore, I have said, and my analysis is based on the basis of what were people's perceptions. I mean, it's not very well to come so many years later and say, you know, they should really have, you know, stormed the crook factory. But the question is, what is their perception? And there is no doubt that their perception was of these young people that if we make manners and morals and the bourgeois lifestyle, if we change the bourgeois lifestyle, we will change society. We will get rid. There's no doubt about that. None whatsoever. And the only question is, if this really went foreign, if this really had the possibility of going foreign, or whether these kids lived in a world of delusion, or to let me put it another way, whether this revolution could not easily be co-opted. You can say this, that today, the revolution which we are talking about is on paper and in art galleries, but that it hasn't really affected the bourgeois lifestyle. Because as you have told me, many of you, in your homes, there is still Jenny tribal. So obviously, it hasn't affected the basic lifestyle. And you might say it is a revolution that is merely cultural and that has come into the art galleries. And that has made possible, if you are an economic determinist, the profession of museum curator and a professor of cultural history. But that has not changed, really, bourgeois society. Right? I'll leave that to you. You could certainly say that. And you can also ask yourself, and this is very topical, because because this is now very much discussed in the women's movement, or in these gay movement, lesbian movement, whatever have you, whether a cultural revolution can in fact change society. Whether in fact you have to have a long period of waiting, Zarathustra, and introspection, and that then you yourself would have the force to prevent. This I think is ridiculous. I'm sorry. This I think is absurd. I think no minority can change society without making alliances with other big forces in society. Well, anyhow, there it is. But I think it's really very unimportant, because I'm not a revolutionary, and quite on nobody hates. So it's really not important. But and I'm not going to discuss the movement. But we do that later. But as far as it's concerned now, I just want to say, this is up to you. But in answering your question, which I think is a very fundamental question, or if the taming of nature is not more or less an inevitable thing, you have to take these things into consideration. And now you must get away from the simple crudity of historical analysis, that you work on your, as Feuerbach said once, the man is what he eats, or that the social system. That's an American Michigan. That's an American positivism that I find very annoying. I don't spend enough time in America to let it get at me, so that much, thank God. But it's very annoying. It has infected young German historiography and made it almost worthless. All of this sort of thing. It's a new kind of positivism. While I am not against, and obviously economic and social factors are crucial, there are other factors that may be equally crucial. And it is up to you to analyze it. And it is to you to put yourself always and ask yourself the question, how did people perceive it? Because you will never understand it if you come in and outside with books they haven't read, things they haven't done. Then you will never understand the motive force. And what we're interested in here is the motive force of men. Because you may say this is a wrong basis, men always have choices. Their choices are circumcised, but they always have some choice. No situation has ever existed when men have no choice. They always have choices. More choices, less choices. But the Germans had a choice in 1933, a great many. And the Russians had a choice in 1918. And there isn't a time when men hasn't had some choice. So that in reality, the question that interests me, it's why people make the choices they do. You must get away from the easy way, the way that lets you sleep at night, the way that gives you hope where there is no hope, that you believe that everything is due to these cosmic forces. I sometimes think you think like history, like a souffle. The middle class rises, and behind it comes the proletariat. The proletariat will destroy the middle class. God knows what, yeah? And the only problem is, of course, there is no proletariat. From the point of view of Denny Tribal, everybody becomes Denny Tribal. And as you will say, is there a working class culture? Not at all. The lifestyle is an imitation of middle class lifestyle, just as one time middle class lifestyle was an imitation of aristocratic lifestyle. So again, lifestyle is, I think, important. Because it is through a lifestyle that people get perception. Very few people read Marx, read Karl Marx's Kapital. He makes this quite clear. Yes? But a lot of people have certain perceptions. Okay, now, before you had a question, yes?
Yes, but
yes, he believes, when he says the chaos of life, he probably believes, that is guesswork, because it isn't too certain, but he probably believed in a kind of Darwinian evolutionary life force. Darwin believed that the life force was obviously an evolutionary life force. In other words, Nietzsche accepted a certain speed. With Nietzsche, evolution, in a way, is speeded up. It's a kind of chaos, but it's a chaos that is constantly changing, yes? It's the kind of thing that Max Nordau condemned so much. When he said your nerves are shattered, because in these days you have one sense impression after another. But Nietzsche takes what Nordau condemned, that you have one sense impression after another, that your nerves are shattered, and he says, no, you must accept that, yes? And there you get this whole bloody business about nerves. The bloody business about nerves. You get, for example, I'll give you another example, the famous address of Max Nordau to the Second Zionist Congress, where he distinguished between pale coffee house Jews and big athletic Zionist Jews. That's the same thing, you see. One are virile, the other are pale and sit and discuss. One act and bash their enemies over the head. These do gymnastics and have Greek bodies. And the others are puny and small. Pale, like we all are, but never mind. Yeah. You had a question, yeah?
Yeah, you mentioned the influence of Nietzsche and cruelty on literature.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what you understand under Nietzsche and cruelty, if you really consider Nietzsche cruel or if you think it's a part of the taking of Nietzsche.
No. The literature is really an edge of cruelty. I would say without the taint. I consider Nietzsche cruel, yes. I mean, that's again up to you. But there's a lot of cruel vocabulary about the whip, about domination. I think it's very difficult not to consider Nietzsche cruel, but you can read him, of course. And yes, I consider Nietzsche cruel. And let me put it this way. I consider he has a cruel edge. Yes? And not just because Zarathustra is with the whip women, but because there is this idea constantly of domination. There is this vocabulary of slavery and of transcending slavery. Yes? And there is no doubt that as Nietzschean literary influence goes, that influence, I would say, was first of all the influence of following life. In other words, of following your nature, yes? After all, a whole generation who wanted to tell the truth about life, yes, without any, you know, convention. But that's one influence. Yeah, you have that state in G. Yes? And the second influence is that literature is now shot through with Nietzschean figures, with Zarathustra. I don't know if you would consider Milonk a Zarathustra, but Milonk is a Nietzschean figure. And Boimelberg, to a certain extent, is a Nietzschean figure. There is no doubt. And that these figures are apt to be, of course, figures of domination, leadership, dominance, and figures which despise the crowd. That's obvious. It's all in Nietzsche, the despising of the herd, which despise the crowd. Certainly, I would say, what you have in the literary influence is that tremendous quest for virility. That isn't there before the end of the century. So, to prove that you want to be a man and that you're not sucked into bourgeois society. And what does it prove, mean to prove to be a man? It means decisiveness. It means the love for truth. It means all of these things that you have, after all, in Zarathustra. Decisiveness. The love for truth. It means woman as the negative feature. Yes? It means the domination over the herd and over women. Over both the herd and women, which with Nietzsche are in the same category. Please remember that. Clear. Domination. And it means, together with that, I think, a certain kind of cruelty. That is to say, cruelty is perhaps not the right word. A certain kind of scrupulousness, without scruple, a certain kind of egoism, narcissism, if you like, enters in it very much. A certain kind of egoism, without scruple, a certain tendency to regard everybody else as the other, the outsider, yeah? The Barthesian, yeah? Who doesn't really matter at all. So, you have all of this in there, I think, in the literary consequences. And again, to finish answering your question, if you wanted to read it in G, you can read it in all of them. G is not the only one, of course, practically everybody. D.H. Lawrence, if that's a concept. Wyndham Lewis, if that's a concept to you. The young Heinrich Mann, but not Professor Unruh. The Expressionists, you see, almost everybody. These would be the markers. And that means, all that means from our point of view here, is that the literary imagination is integrated with the quest for revolt against the bourgeois age. And that it is integrated, as I have said so much, seems to be symptomatic for the nature of this revolt. That this revolt has a nature, and I come back again, that isn't social and economic, but that doesn't mean it isn't genuine. That depends on how much you think such revolts can amount, which is worth discussing, and how much you think that revolts against lifestyles are genuine, or how much you think a revolt against lifestyle is easily co-opted. Now, in a sense, that's prejudice, because all the great revolutionaries of the 60s who wanted to burn down Buscombe Hall are now professors like the rest of us, yes? Fathers of families, that's worse than I am. They're fathers of families, all that sort of stuff. So, the embourgeoisement war is complete. And these young people, I've told you before, some of them became vague socialists. The expressionists are typical here. Some of them became very socialist, some of them became nationalist. But see, I come back here to the center. You cannot live a Nietzschean life. Do you really think you can live a Nietzschean life? Well, I don't think so. I don't even know what it would be, how you would define living a Nietzschean life. Just following your own inner self, you would soon collide with the law, traffic police, your parents. Well, that doesn't matter anymore, I dare say, with everything, no? So, I don't know. But that's, of course, also an open question, and I like to leave these questions to you. But what I must do is to discuss how he was changed in practice, not in theory. Not in the theoretical problem, which I think are very important, but how he was thinking. In fact, do you have any questions about the Blue Angel? Did you see how it's integrated? I think it should be much difficult. I understand some of you had questions. Did you have questions about that? Now, yes, please.
What's your interpretation of what happens with the
question? Well, it is integrated. It's a kind of analogy. The dictator becomes the clown.
I mean, when he goes back to the schoolhouse.
Yes, but he's already disintegrated. The institution is already destroyed. But you can make any interpretation you know. To me, it's the climax of disintegration. He has failed. You can say that Professor Unrat is a very un-Nietzschean figure because he failed. He is like Michael. But at least Michael has some enjoyment. But I guess Professor Unrat has some enjoyment. There is, I suppose, some parallel there. That in the end, Professor Unrat is unequal. He is the dictator who is hypocritical, like the entire bourgeois society. He's hypocritical. When it comes to the punch, he cannot be a Nietzsche. And his virility is not there, because he doesn't dominate Marlene. Marlene dominates him, right? So he is, in fact, the very counter of a Nietzschean figure. As we're coming to an end, I just want to make, because we want to write over 6 weeks, let me make another remark about the 6 weeks. And that is this. Read the questions very carefully. You'll be surprised how many fail because they never read the questions. Answer more than they should. But secondly, keep the main lines of what we have tried to do somewhat in line. And when you have read the question, puzzle it a little. We're not going to grade you about how much you write, but what you write. Remember that. And the final thing, the most important I wish to get, how do we grade? That's why you can be quite relaxed about the 6 weeks. We grade on effort. In other words, if you do better on the 12 weeks than the final, you wipe out the 6 weeks grade. We grade on effort. The 6 weeks grade is best. Will count only, what, 20%, something like that, very isn't it? 20% of your grade. But if you do much better, let's say you get a D on your 6 weeks, but you get a B on your 12 weeks, and on your final you will, of course, get a B for the course. So it's very easy you should be relaxed, therefore, about the sixth. Though I have no great hope for humanity, in this course in the grading I apply, for some idiotic reason, 18th century Enlightenment standards.